spending 20 years of my career talking to families and patients has really shaped the way I view medicine in a much more gray zone. It's not black and white. You learn from the textbooks and then you see a patient and you're like, that's not what the textbook said. And having that happen over and over and realizing that medicine is people. It's people and it's their bodies and it's their stories. And really it's that relationship that's the medicine of, I don't know, and let's do this.
Dr. Beth Vukin has spent the last 20 years as a pediatric hospitalist and a faculty member. When I asked her about practicing medicine as a pediatrician, she said that what she does is really talks to people and listens to the words they use. And lately, this has translated into her own podcast called Real Talk with Kid Docs. But we had such a great conversation, and I was struck by her story of being undiagnosed while practicing medicine and how she went from having a clear path to dealing with real uncertainty, big uncertainty, and how that has changed her perspectives and reprioritized her values. Beth also reminds us how important it is to take care of ourselves and that it's okay to notice when your batteries are low, take a break, figure out what's going on, regroup, and then figure out your next steps. Welcome to the RealMD podcast, Dr. Beth Vukin. So happy to have you here. You recently spoke with Healthcare Stories at Kingsbury Hall, and you are about to speak during a lunch session for RealMD next week. And we're just excited to have you on the episode today. Can you start off by introducing yourself? Tell us what you do, specialty, and then we're going to go all sorts of directions after that.
Yes, great. Sure. I've had a lot of different hats, I guess, in my career. So I did medical school at the University of Cincinnati. I came out here to the University of Utah for residency. I did a residency in pediatrics, stayed on as a chief resident, and then stayed here as faculty as a pediatric hospitalist. And I've done a couple of different things with my non-clinical time. Early in my career, I did a lot of simulation. I was just walking through the building that we're in, and I was like, wow, look at that, a whole simulation center. When I started this, it was a one-room show. But I did simulation for about 10 years on the pediatric side. After that, I did a lot of time with the School of Medicine. I was a clinical CMC stands for, clinical method curriculum? Mm-hmm. Yeah. CMC preceptor.
There's so many acronyms, it's yes. Totally fine, yeah.
I did that for many years. I was part of the pediatric clerkship for many years. I've done a lot of teaching with the residency program. So really my passion is medical teaching. But now I've started to dabble in a bit of quality improvement and doing some administrative time on the pediatric side over at Primary Children's Hospital.
So lots of different roles and a lot of teaching opportunities. Let's go back to medical school. When did you think medical school was something you were going to do? And how did that all come about for you?
Yeah, I am a first generation immigrant. My parents are from Thailand. I'm an only child and an only girl. So if people who know Asian culture, that's a load to bear, I think. And whenever people ask me, I used to think, oh, I have always known I wanted to be a doctor. You know, I had that, ever since I was a little kid. And the more and more I think about it as I get older, I don't know that I knew I had another option. That was from a young age, I was told I was going to be a doctor or an engineer or something of that matter. But the good thing is I actually really love medicine, but I don't know if I knew I had another choice. Mm.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's very relatable. There's like this air in the family culture around you that sort of says, hey, we want you to do this. This is the thing that is acceptable or the thing that will bring us pride.
Right, yeah. Right. There's a lot of that pride. And I come from a non-medical family. Neither of my parents went to college. So it's a big leap I think from when I talk to my family, it's really interesting. My husband, I met in medical school as well, and he is a psychiatrist, and we couples matched and came here. He comes from a very medical family, and it's very different talking with my family and talking with his family.
Yeah. So then you have like these two sort of narratives that come together, and for you and getting into medical school and all of that process as a first gen, what helped you navigate that process?
I honestly, I'm midlife now and kind of looking back at my life a lot, and I don't know what helped me. I think I felt very much like I was on a track. I'm a very traditional student. I went to college, I went to medical school, I went to residency. I stayed at the institution that I did my residency to stay on as faculty. I'm a very straight and narrow path to medicine, which is why maybe I picked up a couple of different hats of like, do I like to do simulation? Do I like to do education? Do I like to do quality improvement? And kind of finding my way. It was pretty easy though to think about going to medical school. It was a very natural path for me. I always really liked school, for one. I'm like a student at heart. I just like going to school. So that was really easy. And gosh, when I felt like when I got to medical school, I found my people. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people in medicine are like that, right? You're kind of finding your people in high school, not so much, maybe a little bit more in college. But in medical school, I was like, these are my people, and really enjoyed that and have really enjoyed my academic career to be able to stay in that medical school teaching environment where I just work with a lot of people who do the same thing but different things.
Yeah.
It's been great.
Were there people that you could remember looking back who had an influence at certain points in the process that stand out to you? Or do you feel like you just sort of saw the steps, you got in the track, and you just like went for it?
Yeah. Gosh, I feel like nobody has ever asked me that question, so I have to think about it. And I feel terrible that I'm like, no. But what really comes to mind is, well, okay, so I'm an only child, and I think any only children out there will know, especially like a Gen X only child, sort of left to my own devices quite a lot of my life, having two really hardworking immigrant parents who worked a lot. You know, I was on my own quite a lot. I think a lot of first-generation immigrant children also recognize that, you know, I quickly knew more about American culture, my English was better. I knew more about how to navigate the world in America more than my parents did. So I think I have that growing up quickly, kind of growing up of where I was like a little adult. And knew I wanted to be a doctor and was like, well, okay, you go to medical school. I'm trying to think, like, I loved my pediatrician. Mm. I remember really enjoying that experience of going into the office, and you know, pediatricians' offices are always so warm and inviting, and everyone is nice to you. I think as a kid, talks to you on your level is like really like you're like the center of attention in a pediatrician's office, which is like really cool when you're a kid. I did not have anyone medical at all in my growing up. I believe at that time I had to shadow a little bit because I remember doing it with my family's family practice doctor when I was applying to medical school. But other than that, gosh, I knew I really liked science. I knew I really liked people. And that was the path I was sort of set on. And I never really questioned it. So it's really very fortunate that I love what I do because I was really just launched onto that path.
Yeah. And I like how you say launched, and you're using these words like, I just sort of, this was my track, and I just happened to really like it too, which, you know, that's a nice path to take. I do think looking back, sometimes you almost have to uncover things because it is in hindsight and because so much time has passed. And I appreciate that you brought up your pediatrician. And obviously, the obvious question is, do you think that early on, the peds specialty sort of emerged to you? Or did you feel like that was, you were almost just modeling what you had observed and enjoyed as a child and said, you know, this is it. This is the thing. Or was there a hard decision to make at some point around specialty?
I think as a going into college and medical school, most people have only ever seen their pediatrician.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're after you see, you sort of graduate from your pediatrician, which that's always a fuzzy line of when that happens. It's sometime when you get kicked off your parents' insurance, I think.
Around
26. Yeah, I'd really only ever seen my pediatrician. And I went to the University of Cincinnati. And so for people who aren't familiar with pediatrics, Cincinnati Children's is a big institution in pediatric medicine. And I really enjoyed my pediatrics rotation. It's doing peds at Cincinnati Children's is a great experience as a third year medical student. I really, really liked it. However, I also, personality wise, don't like to conform always, and everyone in my medical school class wanted to do pediatrics. It was like a third of my class went into pediatrics, and I was like, man, everybody's doing pediatrics. This is sort of lame. I'm going to be different.
Right.
And my year also had a paucity of women. There were only, it was like 30% of the class was women. The year before that, there was some racial tension and some rioting in Cincinnati. And it was very obvious that year, the women in my class either had family in the area or other like really significant ties to Cincinnati, because it was an unsafe city to live in at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was only ever obvious to me when we'd be in small groups and I'd be like the only women. And I would be there with like seven other guys and we'd be talking about some sort of gender issue. And I would like look around and be like, oh, I'm the only woman in this group. Oh, anyway, that's a long roundabout way to say 30% of my class wanted to do peds. All of the women in my class wanted to do peds. And I was like, I'm going to buck the stereotype and I'm not going to do peds for the first time in my life. I'm not going to follow that track. But I loved it. So I'm a very gut feeling person. And man, I was just really happy doing peds. And so that's.
So you said no, and then that just helped you eventually say yes. Yeah.
Yes, yes. It's kind of like you don't want to like ice cream, but like you really do like ice cream. So you're like, yeah, I do.
But I do think sometimes that mental experiment of resisting helps you know. You know, it helps you know. Like, well, now my gut is saying maybe that isn't the way to go. You know.
Yeah.
Because medical school is so fast paced. Knowledge and skill development, clinical experiences, and then you're supposed to have your specialty down and just go. I always wonder about the opportunity for people to take a moment and really think about what it is you want to do and do a gut check. I think there's the rational check, there's the pro and con list, and then there's that other part, like how do I actually feel about this? And not just what the family feels or what the significant people in my life have to say, but how do I feel? So I appreciate you saying that, you know, it can be such a rational left-brained process otherwise, right?
Right. I think especially people in medicine try to rationalize. I know I myself do that, but there's a pretty strong emotional aspect too of where am I happy? Where do I find my people? What type of medicine do I want to practice? And it's interesting. To get into medical school, people are very type A, right? They've got their checklist. They're very goal-oriented, generally very high-achieving people. And for me, I felt like people viewed pediatricians as a lesser specialty. And what I mean by that is, especially as a woman, okay, I went to medical school like 20 years ago at this point, but I think especially as a woman at that time, when I would say I was going to medical school, people would say, oh, that's great. What do you want to be? And I would say a pediatrician. And they would go, oh, that's so sweet. And it was like the natural place. As a woman in medicine, you were going to be an OB or a pediatrician. And it is so sweet. I love pediatricians. I think they're just the best people. And honestly, I think they're the best doctors too, because we're so used to talking to children and families, and that's a hard audience. They really need you to like bring your A game in terms of compassion, being rational, being thoughtful, being humanistic. And whenever I introduce myself, I always just you know, I don't know how people introduce themselves. I mean, people are like, what do you do? And I'm usually like, I work at the hospital. What do you do there? I'm a doctor. What kind of doctor? You know, they kind of like fish around for it. But I'm a pediatric hospitalist, and I in an academic setting, which I think is very rigorous. And I remember thinking about, oh, maybe I'll do med peds, because I feel like the medicine people, people really respect them. They're like the smart ones, right? They're really intellectual, and they think about the hard cases. That's like House, right? Like, mm-hmm. Although I don't know if people are going to get that reference anymore. That show is much more, much
older. I know. The cultural references aren't lining up for me anymore yes. either, but I get it. So it's okay.
But yeah, we're like the thinkers, right? Yeah. And pediatrics is that way. And I almost want to have that as a disclaimer as, oh, but I think really hard. I think about a lot of really complex medicine and physiology too, as well as, you know, child development, parenting skills, and all of those other things. And I think that's what I really loved about pediatrics is, wow, it's so sciencey, and it's also so family oriented and personal oriented and growth and mindset. Like, there's so much of that that goes into being a pediatrician.
Do you think that as you have navigated sort of the, I don't know if it's judgment or stereotyping around peds, that the case that you've built for what it is and why it's fulfilling just becomes so much larger than anybody's assumptions? Do you think, is that what you're sort of saying?
Yeah. I was raised in that generation where we could have it all, right? You could have a career and have a family. And I felt like the way peds was viewed, it definitely wasn't the way it was sold to me. You know, I definitely didn't feel that way with talking with pediatricians. It was, there's so much medicine involved. But to people who are non-medical who would talk to me about it, I felt like it wasn't as respected in a way. As the other fields. And my husband is a psychiatrist. And I felt like when we were both third and fourth year medical students and we were starting to tell people, oh, I'm going to match into pediatrics, I'm matching into psychiatry, I think we felt some people, especially, I'll speak a little bit for my husband, which I feel bad about because he's not here, but at least what he told me was, I'm really smart too. Psychiatry is really interesting, and I'm a doctor, and sometimes I think there's a sense with some of the specialties that people don't view you as much of a doctor as the others, for whatever that means, whatever their stereotype in their mind of a doctor is. And maybe that's our own like insecurity complex.
Part of it. And then we are in a very like subspecialized world where like the more you subspecialize, the more kind of be something, I guess.
Yeah.
In terms of names, titles,
right?
Those sort of things. Yeah.
The opposite of that is, you know, when someone says, well, it's not brain surgery. It's like, you know, brain surgeons are the top of the heap, right? They're the best and brightest.
Right.
But they're all just different skill sets. And I think that's really cool about medicine. And I try to tell that to medical students when they're having a really hard time discussing like what specialty am I going to go into? And it's like, you know, they're all really great. And find what fits for your personality and how you want to be in medicine and what you're passionate about in medicine, because there's a specialty to fit that.
Yeah, and also it's one of those moments, I think, in life where there's probably several that you would be good in and happy and fulfilled in. And then you have this idea of ambiguity, which is just to say, like, here, pick from all of these great things, and they're kind of all going to be a decent, great choice that you'll like. You know, that's a hard choice.
Yeah.
The choice that, you know, the easy choice is, I hate this, I like this. You know,
right.
It's like pretty clear. I think that's the challenge as we get into adulthood, right? Is that things become a little less clear. But when you make a choice that is, as you're describing, that has resistance in it, there's a narrative or an assumption that other people are making. And yet, even though that exists and I'm hearing it and it's hard to navigate, I still choose this. I think that's a powerful choice, you know?
Yeah.
So congratulations.
Well, thank you. I am so, I just love what I do so much. And then to take the next step forward, you can also change it.
Sure.
So I've been a pediatric hospitalist my whole career. I've like never left the walls of primary children's until September.
Yes.
You know, in September of 2023, so about 5 months ago now, I took a leave of absence. And that was because I had a medical diagnosis. I was sick. And it was an abrupt leave of absence. And so finding who I am and what my identity is when I'm not a doctor is interesting. And I feel like I'm on summer vacation right now. I need to figure out what I'm going to do next year. Mm-hmm. And knowing that there's parts of medicine that I love. I love pediatric inpatient medicine. I'm not sure that my body can do that right now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can put in 12-hour days, 7 days in a row, and work nights and weekends and holidays and do the rapid-paced critical thinking and stress level that it takes to manage a team of patients that are sick in the hospital as well as a team of learners. It's a lot, and it's the only thing I've ever done. It's the only thing I've ever known. And then thinking about, what am I going to do if my health doesn't support me doing that,
yeah,
is a big change in my life. And all that to say, it's been really great thinking, okay, well, you know what? There are a lot of different things that I could do.
Yeah.
And that medicine just is, it's so great that it affords you that. It affords not only your specialty, but then a subspecialty if you want to, or I'm going to pivot from inpatient to outpatient, or I'm going to do more administrative time or more teaching time. And gosh, it's a constant flow of like, well, what do I want to do this time? Let's kind of go this way, which is a really big, yeah, privilege to have in your career. You're employable, which is a nice thing.
You are, and there's much more flexibility and opportunity than we allow ourselves to think there is. I think there's you talked about being in a track, and now you're kind of stepping off the track for a minute and trying to figure that out. Can you unpack even more this process of being a physician and also working through a diagnosis? Because it sounds like that's been a lengthy process. Can you give us that story a little bit?
Sure. I have multiple autoimmune diagnoses, so I've had multiple stories about that.
Yeah.
I'll give you the first two in a nutshell, and then I'll move on to the third, which is the more recent. But when... you'll notice my three autoimmune flares with my big diagnoses occurred at points in my time that were very significantly stressful.
Mm.
There's a lot of clear correlation of stress and the impact of stress in autoimmune disease that we're learning more and more about. The first time I had vague, weird symptoms, I was a 20-year-old and I was a pre-med. I was a junior in college, taking the MCAT. I was an RA. I was in my first romantic relationship. It was a very stressful time,
yeah,
in my life, and I developed a weird rash. I developed livedo reticularis, which is a lacy purple web-like rash on my arms and on my legs, which is very striking. It looked like I'd been beat up, but kind of in a weird way because it was like a patterned bruising. I was also exhausted, but I was doing all of those things, and I don't know, like, if there's any other pre-med who's not just, yeah, exhausted. But I was, the rash brought me to bring some attention to myself. And so I saw my family medicine doctor when I was like home on a Christmas break, and I was diagnosed with lupus. I didn't really know much else at the time. I wasn't offered anything. They just said, you have lupus, yeah, which I think at the time, like in 1999, if you were a 20-year-old female and had a positive ANA and some weird symptoms, I think they told you you had lupus. And so anyway, went on my way away. 4 years later, I was a third-year medical student, and I was so tired. I argue that all third-year medical students are really tired. And then,
right,
I think when you're in that, you're like, well, how tired is too tired? When do I go see the doctor because I'm too tired? But the rash came back, which was a helpful sign.
Yeah.
And then I developed a wrist drop and a foot drop. And all of that occurred over like 6 months or so. You know, when I say it in one sentence,
yeah,
they're like, oh, well, yeah, you clear. 24-year-old female presents,
sure,
with a livedo reticularis, fatigue, and a wrist drop and a foot drop. You're like, well, clearly. But it all came and went, and it was really hard. But when I was a third-year med student, I was like, wow, everyone around me is a doctor. They're going to figure this out. But it took many months and many tests and many different specialists. But I finally got the diagnosis of polyarteritis nodosa, which I learned is like a 40-year-old man disease. And okay. I remember thinking,
you're like, this doesn't
that's not right. I don't. And in the healthcare stories that I was talking about, I talk about being a pre-med and being like a child in the house of medicine with my parents being medicine and being like, oh, yeah, I don't feel good. And I go to my parents and it's medicine. And they're like, oh, yeah, this is what's going on. We'll take care of you. And I'm like, huh. Well, that's so great. You figured that out, and I'm going to get to be a doctor one of these days. That's so awesome. And then I was a third-year medical student, and I saw all these doctors, and they would just kind of look at me. Anyone with unexplained symptoms or autoimmune disease knows that look, where they kind of cock their head to the side, and they just go, huh. And you're like, yeah, you don't know. That's okay. I've gotten very comfortable with, like, the stump the doctor, where you're like, yep, you don't know. That's all right. What are we going to do about it?
Right.
Anyway, so as a third-year medical student, which is a terrible time to have mysterious symptoms, by the way, because you think you have everything that you have just read about. So I felt like I was more of a teenager during this time where I was like, I don't know if that's right. I might know more than you on this because I've read it. You know, I had a lecture on it. I think I know about polyarteritis. Anyway, so fast forward, I went 20 years without any other – well – people ask me if I had symptoms. I'm like, well, yeah, I did. I had some weird symptoms that no one could ever explain.
Yeah.
But at this point, I have a couple of autoimmune diseases. So I was like, well, I don't know. I guess it's just that. But about 3 years ago, I started getting really tired. And to the point where I felt like I had brain fog. And I couldn't quite think clearly. And I was not sleeping well, but I was sleepy all the time. And so I felt like I had to take a nap every day. And coming home from work after a busy service, I could make it through dinner and then I would just pass out. But 3 years ago was also a year into the pandemic. At that time, I had a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. My husband and I both kept our full-time physician jobs while homeschooling a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. And I think everyone was like, well, of course you're tired. The whole world is tired. So I had vague symptoms for a while during that period. And then 2 years ago, I had a weird symptom. My hands got puffy. And my forearms got really tight. And so I read and I think, oh, well, I have scleroderma. It's a good thing I have a rheumatologist. So I, you know, messaged my rheumatologist and said, I think I have scleroderma. And he got me in right away and did my history and a physical exam. And he said, oh, well, your hands don't look too puffy. Tell me why you think you have scleroderma. And gosh, that was the first time that I felt doubted by medicine. You know, all the other times I went to medicine, they didn't really know what I had, but it wasn't like they were like, well, I don't know if you have anything. And this time I was like, gosh, well, I don't know. I've had symptoms that were kind of vague for 3 years and, oh, maybe they're not swollen. To which I kept telling myself, like, these are your hands. You know that they're swollen and can't really hold a pen anymore. And my arms were getting fatigued, like, you know, opening a jar or stirring a bowl. I would have to like rest my arms. And so I felt like something was wrong. So into that diagnosis, fast forward a couple years later, my testing for scleroderma 3 years ago was negative, but I have 3 autoimmune diseases and I've never once had an elevated ESR, CRP, or even so much as a white count, never anything, not even increased platelets, nothing. My testing is always normal. And I also know that I present as really well appearing. So even when I feel terrible, I show up to work, I smile, I take care of patients, I take care of my family. And I think that's something that as parents and as doctors, we've been conditioned to do that, right? We work really hard. And when we do it, we talk to every patient as if they're like our only patient of the day. And I think we just get so accustomed to, I feel terrible and I'm going to do my job. So all that to say, I ended up getting a diagnosis after repeated testing a couple of years later, and I had known for three years I have scleroderma. And so finally my testing came back positive. My doctor called me and she said, you probably saw your my chart. And I said, yes, I did. I have scleroderma. Okay, now can we do something? That's great. Great. What are we going to do? And a few days later, I had a meeting with my boss, who's amazing. She's the Dr. Tiffany Glasgow, who many, many of you know, and she was amazing. I think of her as such a great mentor, and I told her my diagnosis, and she said, oh my gosh, well, and you know, she, of course, let me talk about it quite a bit. Yeah. And then I think she said, you know what? I think you should take a break. And I was thinking, this was September at the time, and I was thinking, take a break? What are you talking about? We're preparing for viral season. Lehigh's going to open. Like, what are you talking about? We are like in the full throes of things. And gosh, she gave me that permission to take care of myself and acknowledge that the work that we do is hard. It's not only physically taxing, it's mentally taxing, it's emotionally taxing. And that now is the time for me to take care of myself.
Yeah. That's a powerful story on so many levels. I love that you brought up the parent-child relationship, and I know that was a key element of your story that you told too, but in this idea of figuring out who you are and becoming an adult, there is the early stages where you're sort of being acted upon and told, you know, you're the kid, I'm the parent, I'm going to tell you what to do. I'll tell you what your diagnosis is, and even in that doctor-patient sort of hierarchy. And then this moment of you kind of sort of rising up and knowing these are your hands and this is who you are, and maybe you understand what this diagnosis is before other people do, and having to trust that and be questioned. And yeah, I just think that's a powerful story about what it's really like. But you also started on a really set track. We talked about this a little earlier. And as you've come into more of who you are, you're also being asked to not be on a set track a little bit. How are you processing that right now?
Yeah, I'm about 5 months in. So I've gone through all of my like stages of grief, of diagnosis and losing professional identity as a physician. So I've had a good amount of time to go through those stages and really think about what's important to me. And gosh, I feel so lucky. I'm very grateful to look at my life and my career and say, wow, I've had a great one. My whole life, all I ever wanted was to have a family and to be a doctor. And I got both, and I'm so lucky. And now, when really my major symptom is fatigue. And if I really, I can only ever get my battery to 15%. So if that's what I've got, I'm going to choose my family.
Yeah.
And to be in that position where I can choose my family and know that, wow, I had a great career in medicine, and not even that it's over, but I had such a good run. I felt, not every day, but fulfilled and valued. I wish I could say I felt that every day. But, you know, I've had enough experience in my life to have those experiences balance out the bad times and the hard times. You know, there's definitely, I talk to my team a lot about crying in the team room. It's okay to come cry in the team room. Come cry in the team room. We all need to cry in the team room. But that going through that process of being a young doctor and then being a mid-career doctor and mentoring medical students and residents and young families and seeing people go through really hard times and doing that with them has been so meaningful in my life. And that chapter might be closed in the inpatient medicine side, but it might not be.
Yeah.
And I think the older I get and the farther along you get in medicine, you get like longer sight, right? Like when you're in college, like I just have to get in med school. And when you're in med school, I just have to get in residency. And then I just have to finish residency. And now I'm kind of in the long game of like, what am I going to be able to sustain? Which is a great thing to be in of like, now what do I want to do? But it is different. I would say I weathered that loss of professional identity better because I've been thinking about professional identity for a long time. It wasn't that abruptly, Dr. Glasgow was so great, and she just said, "We'll cover you. don't worry about it. Like, and I was like, oh, well, let me see if I can just switch maybe this week and this other week. And then I can totally pick it back up, like, you know, in a couple months. And she was like, nope. Don't worry about it at all. And my colleagues picked up all of my service weeks, my admin. I have about a quarter time on admin products. Those were all completely picked up. So overnight, my work schedule was cleared in terms of clinical service. As hospitals, we work nights, weekends, holidays. I was supposed to work Thanksgiving and Christmas this year. Being on admin time, tons of emails, meetings, and all of a sudden my calendar was completely clear, like overnight. And that was, well, I think honestly at that point, I was so exhausted from my disease. I literally slept for the majority of the first month. And then got to have a little bit of perspective of now what do I want to do? But then even for the last 3 or 4 months, I've felt too sick to really even consider working. I had my initial FMLA, which was 3 months. And during that 3 months, I had this goal of, okay, well, I'm going to go back to work in January. It's 3 months. And it was beginning of December when I thought, oh man, I'm going to go back to work in the height of viral season with Lehigh opening as well. And that, I don't think I can do it. I don't. And I think that was the hardest part of feeling like I couldn't do it physically and cognitively. I can't be a doctor. It's not like, you know, I broke my leg and I can't do that race. It's, I don't think that I can do it mentally, and my job is hard, lives are at stake, and to admit to myself, and particularly to admit to my boss, I don't think that I'm fit to take care of patients right now. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's safe, and I'm going to take myself out of the game, which that part was the hardest part.
Yeah. There's so much that you're saying. I just want to reflect back and appreciate your words, noticing that where your battery is. Like, I'm at 15%. Noticing even in those three major transitions where you were experiencing something and you weren't even sure what it was, that you could rationalize it into just being tired because that's the phase. Noticing that. There's a lot of, I think, self-awareness both internally about who you are, but also like physical awareness of like where I'm at. You know, I'm a driven person. I'm used to just like going, pushing through, powering through. We almost have that cultural expectation too of physicians, and I think of anyone really, just like that you can just keep pushing and somehow you're going to make it through, and then you'll rest up and it'll be fine. Has this given you like a completely different awareness of what self-care is and like what it means to I really appreciate that Tiffany Glasgow gave you permission. And then you've also stepped up and started to give yourself permission. I'm just very, I think, taken back by how these experiences really start to teach us when the uncertainty is 100% in your face, that uncertainty will start to teach you more about yourself than you could possibly learn if everything were going like right as rain, you know?
Right. Gosh, I think about self-care. And so I've started having symptoms about 3 years ago. And I saw doctors. I saw many different doctors for all of my various vague ailments, and no one could ever find anything. So I did what we tell patients with unexplained symptoms to do and said, okay, well, what things can I do, and what things do we know help fatigue, insomnia, brain fog, depression? Like, what do we know? Okay, let's think about nutrition. And think about movement in a way that is really good for my body and also what my body can do. Let's think about stress management. So actually during that nearly 3-year period before I actually had an official diagnosis of scleroderma, I had gotten myself much better. I read a lot about autoimmune disease because I was like, well, clearly something I have is autoimmune. And did all of the things that the internet tells people with autoimmune disease to do. And I actually started feeling quite a bit better. And by the time I had to do my follow-up, so I saw my first rheumatologist about 2.5 years ago, and everything was negative at that time. And he said, well, if nothing else comes, we'll just recheck your labs in a year, like we always do. And when I came back for my follow-up, he had actually moved to another institution. So I saw a new rheumatologist. And when I came in, I had a chip on my shoulder, and she said, what brings you in? And I said, well, I think I have scleroderma, but nobody else thinks I have scleroderma, and my testing is all negative. But now my hands are really tight and contracted, and my forearms are stiff. So I really do think I have scleroderma. I'm just kind of wondering what you think. And she looked at my hands, and I said, now, my hands look really good right now because I've been taking care of myself. I've been doing all of my personal OT. I've stretched. I look really good right now. But I also know what my triggers are. So if you want, I can do all of my triggers and I can put myself into a flare and I can come back and you can see what my hands look like and what my forearms look like. And I look visibly ill.
Yeah.
And that's when she said, I believe you. And I remember thinking, you do? Because I know I look fine. I look fine. Everybody says, oh, I wouldn't even know you're sick. And I feel terrible. And I think that's the hard thing about having autoimmune disease is many of the autoimmune diseases are invisible. You look well. People can't tell that there's anything wrong. And the predominant symptoms that are invisible to people are things like fatigue and brain fog, where you can look fine, but you don't feel like yourself. And especially when your brain is affected, you don't feel like you can do the things you normally do, and you're not who you are. And I think that's the hardest part, you know, having some physical things, some muscle pain and joint pain and contractures and things like that is one thing. But when you feel like you're not yourself and you're not thinking clearly, I think especially as a physician, it's very unsettling.
Do you feel like the empathy developed through this whole process makes you a different physician even? I mean, I know you're not practicing right now, but do you feel like a different physician?
I do. It's been that whole evolution, right? From 20 years ago, having unexplained symptoms and being told I have something and, oh yeah, sure, I have lupus, let's go, we'll treat it. And then having polyarteritis and treating it. And, you know, I actually was being on immune suppression during my intern year, and then after that was off. But then 20 years went by where I was healthy. I didn't have anything. But during that 20-year period, I was working as a pediatric hospitalist, and gosh, one of the things that can get you admitted to the hospital is having prolonged, vague symptoms that people can't explain. And we talk about admitting for multiple consultations and multiple tests. Let's just bring him to the big house and we'll get everything done. We'll talk to everybody we know. And parents during that time, when we can't figure it out, mainly because we rule out a lot of things, right? We talk about like, well, we know it's like these 500 things that it's not, but we don't know what it is. And when parents hear that, they think these doctors don't know what they're doing. And when patients hear that, they think they don't believe me. My symptoms aren't real. Like maybe nobody can help me. You know, I've gone to all of these doctors and now I've gotten admitted to the hospital and I've been in the hospital for a week and I've seen everybody and nobody knows. And being on the physician side of that is where I spent like the last 20 years. And how to talk about, it's all in the way you talk about it. And as a medical specialty, as pediatrics is, like I don't have a scalpel or, you know, procedures, my medicine is talking to people and hearing them and saying, okay, this is what you're feeling. Tell me more about that. And listening to the words they use. and then crafting what I think they have based on what they've said and what their exam looks like and what labs and tests look like, and then handing it back over to them and saying, this is what I think. And when you don't know, you have to craft those words really carefully. And spending 20 years of my career talking to families and patients who don't necessarily have a diagnosis or have a really rare diagnosis that people don't really understand either, has really shaped the way I view medicine in a much more gray zone. It's not black and white. Spending all of that time in medicine, you learn from the textbooks, and then you see a patient and you're like, that's not what the textbook said. And having that happen over and over and realizing that medicine is people. It's people, and it's their bodies, and it's their stories, and people present differently. And really, it's that relationship that's the medicine of, I don't know, and let's do this. And even if that is just, let's see you again in a week. Why don't we think about it some more? Give me some time to think. I'm going to have you keep a diary of your symptoms. I want you to think about these things, and let's talk again. And I feel like that part of medicine has been lost to some degree, especially with how fragmented our healthcare system is, where it's like, well, saw neurology, not my problem. Saw GI, not my problem. And where is that person who leads the ship? You know, and that's what we say is primary care's role, but we keep giving more roles to primary care. I don't know how many things we can give them. And we've lost that team aspect. I think that's the thing I miss most about working in the hospital, is I love having a team. And all of these different people who have different inputs, you know, from the nurses to the OTs to the pharmacists to the dietitians, everyone's got a different piece that brings it all together for the patient. And what we really need, and what I did as a hospitalist, was bring those people together to distill, like, what are we going to do for this patient and this family?
I think you did a really good job of framing how formative this experience has been, because I think it's shifted your whole perspective of and increased your maybe appreciation of the process of being with a patient and witnessing what's happening to them and working through a diagnosis and even being believed by a physician, as you said earlier, like how powerful that is for a physician to believe their patient, you know, and to hear them and to reflect back what's happening to them, to validate that their experience matters. And of course, trying to find the right diagnosis and treatment and create a plan and all those things. I don't think that part's necessarily changed, but wow, the empathy part and the wanting to really understand people and stay with them, I think that's really powerful. Like, then, you know, it feels like, just like you said, you know, like you're getting to the sort of those fundamental pieces of being a physician that we can lose, you know? Yeah, I'm really struck by all of that. And I think that's a great reminder. And then I wanted to reflect back one thing to you is, you know, you've had a pretty strong plan in how you described everything. And now like this new phase is, what's the plan? You know, there's like, I need to get used to not knowing the plan, you know? And that's an interesting, I think all of us, I say this to people all the time, like at some point in your professional identity and who you are as a person, there will be multiple moments where what's happening is really shocking. Like, what is this? I have no idea what to do with this, you know? And I think those moments are, obviously, there's the most learning that can happen there, but I don't want to just say, oh, and yeah, and then you learn and everything's fine. I don't think it's as simple as that, but it's certainly, there's so much value in it, in the pain too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During this process, at the holiday party last year for Department of Pediatrics, it's like this, you know, big gala. And I was talking to a colleague of mine with my husband, and he he and I work on the medical informatics side of like trying to make the EMR look more physician friendly.
Wow, that's a tough job. Right.
Anyway, so he was talking to my husband and he said, gosh, do you know that Beth is doing this amazing work? And I wish I could remember how he said it, because I was like, wow, is that what I'm doing? You know, he was like, wow, she's leading changes in medicine by making our EMR more functional. And anyway, he said it much more eloquently. And I looked at him and I said, is that what those Monday meetings are all about? I feel like I'm just nitpicking over like where the font is, could be bigger. And could you move that column to the right? But anyway, he, you know, very, very senior'd, has mentored me some in my career and was like, Beth, you have so much more to offer than being a clinician. And I was like, what do you mean? Because I'm clinical faculty, which means I'm 70% of my time is clinical and 30% is administrative and teaching. And so that's the most clinical you can get. And I've always thought about myself as a clinician. I've never been on a research track or anything like that. And I really felt like my value add was clinical medicine. And he said, you have so much more. There's other stuff. You see how the system works. You see how people work. And gosh, like that was the first time in my life that I ever thought that I have something to add other than seeing patients. And now that I'm like mid-career, I'm like leaning into that, right? Like, oh, I've done a lot of patient care. So now I have lots of wisdom to offer. But gosh, like really thinking about that. And that's one of the reasons why I really love the educational side, because gosh, I think especially as a student, you get so caught up in your STEP scores and learning all these things that when do you ever learn how to be a doctor, how to talk like a doctor, how to deal with, wow, you take on a lot of people's emotion and hardships, and how do you manage that and then go home and have your life too and not be cold and not distance yourself, but also be able to like embrace it. And it's a lot. And I think that we don't get to talk about that. And so that's where I've really gotten excited recently, yeah, is like talking about that part of medicine that we don't really ever get taught. You're sort of supposed to learn that on the fly, and it's the hardest thing to learn.
Yeah. And we're so good at trying to measure ourselves in some performance metric that tells you that you're worth something and that you're good at this, and really good at tearing ourselves apart when we're not meeting the standard that we expect. And medicine pretty quickly humbles you, I think, in those areas. And you know, I love that story you told about somebody sort of telling you, wait a minute, you're really good at this. Because often the thing that you're good at, you know, you have the things like, well, I'm this, I'm that, like those concrete statements. I'm a clinician. This is the percentage of my FTE that's spent doing this. And I dabble in teaching and I like that too, but I'm this. And you're sort of telling yourself you're that. But when someone stops you and says, wait a minute, you're not even noticing this and you're actually really good at this, I think that's when you know it's a strength, because it's happening so automatically that you can't even see it, that someone else has to say, you know, and all those other things we're talking about that medical students and all of us get caught up in are those metric things that we're trying to tell ourselves are so important. And yet, you know, there's these things that you're really good at that hopefully you're starting to see, which is really great. You know, I think that's a good lesson, I think, for all of us, that there's so many things that we're actually really good at if we would just hear other people telling us, hey, wait a minute, you're really good at this.
Yeah, I think that's something we don't hear enough. I think in working with medical students and residents, we always talk about feedback, right? And making sure it's a very pointed, directed feedback about something, not just you're doing a great job, but what are you doing that is so great? And I think, gosh, I love giving that type of feedback. Yeah. It's not just like, good job, you knew that answer. It's like, wow, you were so thoughtful in how you broke that bad news. That was going to be really, really hard. And I noticed that you read the room and felt and noticed when, okay, I should probably pause here. And good job with that. Or, gosh, you know what? You really acknowledged what that nurse was saying. You really validated her concerns and still stated your opinion and worked really collegially. Wow, that was so powerful. So yeah, a lot of the work that I was doing with quality improvement is working on team dynamics, and how do we as a team work better together? We're trained in these silos, like doctors think this way and nurses think this way and pharmacists think this way. And gosh, but then you really work as a team. It's how do you work as a team? And I've been really excited to do a bit more of that.
Yeah. Well, you're certainly in a process of like active self-discovery and writing the next chapter, and starting to think about the next chapter, taking a moment. I always quote Dr. Susan Sample when she says, like, there's these moments where you can step out of time, out of all the things that you have to do. Those are really great moments, you know, to process what has happened and maybe what the next phase or direction will be. I'm so glad you're sharing your story. I think it really matters that, you know, that we have these new experiences that are unexpected and challenging come up, and we don't always get a chance to even hear them, you know. If we just want to hear like a happy ending, or like when this thing gets resolved, like when you're in it. And I really think that's powerful that you're in it.
Well, thank you for letting me share my story.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This episode of the RealMD podcast is produced and edited by Tom Hurtado and Ali Day. Special thanks to Scott Singpil, Scope Radio, and University of Utah Health. The RealMD podcast is part of the RealMD program at the Spencer Fox Eccles School of Medicine at the University of Utah, which helps medical students find meaning, community, and purpose during their training and future careers. Our theme song, Energizer Bunny, is by my son's band, Hurtado. You can find our podcast on major platforms, and if you like what you hear, please follow us or subscribe. You can also help us grow by giving us a 5-star review and sharing an episode with a friend. Thank you so much for listening.